chef on the line, ever. Yet in a famous pre-opening black-and-white photograph circulated by publicist Brooks Hamner, McCarty is grouped along with Frank, Peel, and Waxman in full kitchen regalia. There are those, like veteran L.A. diners Manny and Willette Klausner, who don't recall Michael selling himself as the chef, but some Michael's veterans make a point of telling me he didn't cook, as if writing the historical record, some explicitly so. For so many years, he called himself the chef, says Peel. When I was there for the first year and a half, Michael did not cook once. But I understand why he would want to do that. Michael, you should know, was never in the kitchen, volunteers Frank. Reichel supports all of this. He was not in the kitchen. I spent most of my time with Jonathan. I spent very little time with Ken. I don't know why. Jonathan was just really nice to me. Even though Ken was the chef, Jonathan was the one who seemed to be spending a lot of time playing around in the kitchen. Michael was dealing with the furniture, with the carpenters, with the digital guys, with supplying. But I never saw him do one thing in the kitchen. McCarty's take? Chef in French means the chief. And that I was. I will always be that. McCarty doesn't volunteer this today. But Reichel remembered that he considered it a coup to have Frank on board, even as he, perhaps sensing the industry's ground shifting beneath his feet toward a chef-centric template, worried that the restaurant would become known as Ken Frank's Place.
I think his name should be above Ma Maison.
Things had plateaued between Puck and Tarai at Ma Maison. Yet, were it not for a chance encounter between Puck and Barbara Lazaroff, a Bronx-born pre-med student, they might have lasted longer than they did. Lazaroff, the middle child and only girl in her family, refers to her young self as a hippie without the drugs. Nicknamed the Bohemian by her mother, she dressed to her own beat, but liked to be in control. She attended Woodstock in 1969.
I remember everything. I didn't have a camera then, but the pictures are in my head. Everybody was so stoned.
She came to Los Angeles for love. The relationship cooled once she arrived, but she took to the city, especially the weather.
I was always a little sad in New York, because I'm one of those people that is affected by lack of light, she says. It's very hard for me because I'm a visual person. My house is full of color. I love gardens. I grew up very poor. I didn't have an opportunity to have any pets, gardens, or anything. I have 400 rose bushes on the other side of the house, there from 1927. When they bloom, I'm in ecstasy. I love art. All of that.
Lazaroff wasn't immune to the wanderlust that connected her generation's dots, but couldn't afford to travel. So she settled for New York University, a microcosm of everything that turned her on, especially the arts and theater. When her mother learned that she had only applied to NYU, she chastised her, chasing her around with a rolled-up newspaper.
She never hit me, but she bopped me on the head. How can you do this?
Mama Lazaroff didn't yet realize her daughter's powers of self-realization.
I said, I'm getting in, and I'm getting a scholarship. And I did.
Lazaroff initially planned to study theater design at NYU. She took courses in puppetry. Criticism, lighting design. She painted stages. She designed sets and did makeup. She even acted. But she switched to the more dependably lucrative field of medicine, in part to ensure she could finance a life of travel and adventure, continuing to study at NYU, then Hunter College, then Berkeley, then came to L.A. with plans to finish her studies and become a physician. In L.A., Lazaroff belonged to a gym, lugging along a massive organic chemistry book and studying between sets. A statuesque, strawberry blonde French woman, Gabrielle, found the Gilda Radner-like spectacle unbearably sad and invited Lazaroff to a private party at a local club. When a French gigolo art forger, Lazaroff's description, hit on her, she turned to his diminutive friend and asked him if he'd like to dance. It was Puck. Breaking with his newly adopted M.O., Puck revealed himself to Lazaroff as a chef, asked her if she liked to cook, and invited her to his class at Ma Cuisine. He was mid-demo when she arrived, late, and the sight of her caused him to drop his butter on the floor. Next, she came to lunch at Ma Maison, decked out in a stretchy white suit and purple blouse, but wouldn't let him hold her hand because she was still with her boyfriend. Puck was technically still married at the time, to Marie-France Trouillot, an old love from France who had joined him in L.A., but both relationships were on life support. Hand-holding or not, they entered into a courtship. Within a week and a half, Lazaroff was helping Puck write Modern French Cooking for the American Kitchen, a planned Ma Maison cookbook to be published by Houghton Mifflin. Presented with a rendering of the cover at a creative meeting, she insisted,
"You know, I think his name should be above Ma Maison, because he's leaving Ma Maison. He's going to be more important than Ma Maison, and this is his book."
Puck kicked her under the table. After the meeting, he fretted aloud that they wouldn't publish.
"Oh, don't be silly," she told him.
Told the story, Reichel says,
"I think that is a perfect example of the two of them then. She was just, 'You are going to be famous, and I'm going to make this happen any way I can.'"
Lazaroff was right. The book came out with Puck's name inscribed in script above, and larger than the title. The subtitle, lodged beneath a David Hockney watercolor drawing of the restaurant, was Recipes from the Cuisine of Ma Maison. And Lazaroff was right about something else. By the time the book hit store shelves, Puck was gone from Ma Maison. You weren't there, if you can remember it. Michaels opened in April 1979 to mixed reviews. Los Angeles magazine's Bruce David Cullen savaged the restaurant, directing his rage primarily on McCarty, whom he found insufferably haughty and insincere on his first visit. When Reichel's New West piece broke, she quoted McCarty, saying, "I'm not a 50-year-old Frenchman who owns the restaurant and is mean." Referring to his kitchen team and why they came to him, he said, "They've all been working with these crusty old bastards who treat them like assholes and won't let them do anything creative." McCarty, fearful of offending Bertrandoux, called Coleman Andrews, demanding a retraction, but Reichel had it all on tape, so New West refused.
"Michael's was a very magical place," remembers John Sedler, who checked it out with fellow L'Hermitage cook Roy Yamaguchi, who now presides over a chain of more than 20 Roy's restaurants around the United States. "It was brash, and he was sassy, and he had modern art and great wine. It was a party. It was youthful. Everything was European up until that time, and this was something Californian."
Kleiman delineates the subtle differences between California native Martyr and East Coast transplant McCarty.
"They were both very, very attached to the whole art scene, but I saw Bruce as being more outsider, more edgy, because the hippie thing has ended. The disco thing hasn't quite started yet. So there's this period of time where it's like, who are the edgy people? Well, they're the artists. Michael's, that space was just so thought out and so slick, and yet it had this huge patio in the middle of it. It had all this amazing art on the walls. It was filled with light. They were both very prescient at the time."
For all the bonhomie in the dining room, behind the scenes, tension between Frank and McCarty was growing. One early incident that rankled Frank had to do with a duck farm that McCarty said he and Bertrandoux had started in Acton, just north of the San Gabriel Mountains. McCarty promoted it in the press, including in the New York Times, but according to Frank, he misrepresented it. "Michael is very loose with the truth," says Frank. "I remember sitting in an interview with Lois Dwan from the Los Angeles Times, and Michael was telling her about the ducks he was raising, and the partnership and the farm, and it was just a flat-out lie. They never succeeded in producing foie gras, and they never succeeded in having a very viable duck farming operation. Michael would claim, of course, that he was a partner in this. And he would claim, of course, when we were at Michael's, we were serving ducks that were grown on his farm. But in fact, we were buying the same frozen ducks from Harvey Gussman at Gus Meat Company that Jean Bertrandoux was buying for L'Hermitage, which was a particularly good pekin duck with a large breast. It was a particular breed from a particular farm that we all decided was the best. When the two sat for an interview with W's Mary Rourke, says Frank, McCarty spoke of an illegal restaurant he'd owned in Paris and was forced to close, and of how he longed to return to France and try again someday. And of course, he had never owned a building in Paris, or had a restaurant in Paris, says Frank. Many interview subjects expressed skepticism about that duck farm, and Colin, in his Los Angeles Magazine review of the restaurant, wrote, "McCarty claims to be partners with Bertrenu in the duck farm the latter underwrote several years ago." Terai helpfully explained to me that he bought the ducks for Ma Maison, but that they were too small to use. But neither McCarty's involvement in the farm, its success in breeding usable ducks, nor McCarty's other possible acts of self-mythology seemed to rankle anybody the way they do Frank. The prevailing affection for McCarty is summed up by Melvin Master, a British-born wine expert, marketer, and restaurateur who knew McCarty in his Denver days. "Michael was a great marketing guy. He was passionate about food. He talked the talk. He was the real deal. There was a lot of BS to Michael, but it was genuine BS, if you will." Frank didn't share the charitable view of McCarty, nor did he socialize with him or the rest of the Michael's crowd at his Malibu house, which he found incestuous. They'd ride to work together, go home together, stay up at night, get high, talk about food, and hang out, says Frank. "And I went home to my house after work." Like Terai and Puck, McCarty and Frank had much in common, both among the very few in their generation who committed early to a life in restaurants. And both were American, both Francophiles. But they couldn't get along, largely because both craved credit and dominance. Another gem from Colin's review: the official billing in the PR program notes read, "Chef Owner, Michael McCarty, assisted by Ken Frank." Given the egos of both men, I wonder how long that association will last. For the present, at least, McCarty seems content to do his mixing out front. McCarty denies it, but Frank says that he was eventually banned from the Michael's dining room because he knew so many customers from past gigs. Similarly, Puck recalls that when he began to get over his shyness at Ma Maison, "If I talked to a customer, Patrick went right away there, too, to talk to them." Frank departed Michael's after just 4 months, but deciphering the reason why is a quandary for which the word Rashomon seems to have been created. Remembers Waxman, "After about 2 months of this, Ken goes, 'I don't want to be the head chef anymore. I want you to be the head chef. I am going to open my own restaurant, but I can't afford to leave right now. So can I be the sous chef and you can be the head chef?' So we switched, and I became the head chef." "That's a flat-out lie," says Frank. "A figment of his imagination. I got fired from Michael's because I was tired of taking shit and didn't take shit anymore, and knew I had this other deal working. I got fired from Michael's, and I can tell you the date. You can go look it up in the employment records. It was August 5. Was because Michael was charging us. He had a manager named Carl who was counting the number of espressos we drank in the kitchen so he could deduct the cost of the espressos from our paycheck. And I said it was bullshit. 'If I'm working 14 hours a day and you're going to charge me for the espresso I drink to stay up, fuck you.' And I probably told it to him just like that." That is specifically what triggered it. But the restaurant was broke when it first opened, and he missed a number of payrolls. He finally got them caught up because he was busy paying money for other things. He very much took advantage of his cooks. So I called him on that too, and he didn't like that either." "That I have no recollection of," laughs McCarty of the espresso charge. But he does offer, "It was a madhouse, and if anything, so many fundamentals were broken in those days. For example, I would take them all out to dinner. We would have the wildest times. Everything about that first year, even the first 10 years, are fundamental rules that you do not break between employer and employee. Lines were blurred. I mean, the stories in my restaurant at 2 o'clock in the morning, what was going on in the walk-ins. Remember, Blow was in the 80s. Blow was a big deal. and a big deal amongst our clients. And it was a raucous time. So if you're going to hear different stories, you are going to hear different stories. As they used to say, you weren't there, if you can remember it. And it was true. McCarty also blames Frank for terminating his tip pool. A Labor Department person came to my restaurant a year plus one day after he left and said this complaint was filed saying that he didn't get paid what he was supposed to get paid. And I said, well, I have a computerized payroll system. Here's all of his records. I think Michael actually fired him after 6 months, says Peel, who doesn't remember Frank being banned from the dining room, but says that it rings true and imagines the espresso contretemps was a symbol for Ken of diminished stature. Thinking about it now with years behind me, thinking about it from Michael's perspective, I do understand that. Here he had put in a lot of his own money, his reputation on the line opening this place. The restaurant cannot hinge on the chef because if the chef leaves, it's like sticking a pin in a balloon. With Frank gone, Waxman was elevated to chef. He introduced what would become a signature dish for decades, a half chicken with fries and tarragon butter, and changed the menu regularly, experimenting. He found the Los Angeles dining public remarkably open to new ideas, even unsuccessful ones. They were the most enthusiastic audience you could ever imagine, says Waxman. They were so enthusiastic they were overly enthusiastic. They loved everything. They tolerated the mistakes. I knew they were mistakes as soon as they went out of the kitchen, but they weren't horrible mistakes. They were mistakes of youth. The freedom was intoxicating. I remember going to see Wolfgang Puck for the first time at lunch at Ma Maison. He had worked at all these famous restaurants in Paris, more classically trained than anybody I knew at the point, except for Jean-Pierre Moule at Chez Panisse. He looked at me and it was like, this is great, right? This is cool, right? We get to do what we want now. We get to be the chef. There aren't any rules anymore. But an excess of anything, even enthusiasm, can backfire. Once, when Waxman was away on vacation, Peel ran 16 specials, 4 cold appetizers, 4 hot appetizers, 4 meat main courses, and 4 fish dishes. Just reciting them caused delays on the service floor. I had all of these things I wanted to do, so I just did all of them, says Peel. I had to promise the waiters I would never do that again. The restaurant became a beacon for young American talent, though many, according to Peel, left after a little while because they got sick of the turmoil. It was not a button-down kitchen, at all. It got a little crazy sometimes. After the restaurant closed, people would stay up and drink champagne and talk and do cocaine. One of those drawn to McCarty's flame was Nancy Silverton, a young cook who had grown up one of 2 daughters of an attorney, father, and writer, mother, in Los Angeles. She first entered the kitchen pursuing a flirtation at Sonoma State University. I bought a cookbook, and I started cooking out of it. It was quite early on in following these recipes and realizing how much I enjoyed, first of all, just kind of being by myself, but also how much I felt comfortable and enjoyed using my hands. And it was that first semester that it was like a light bulb went off. It was that memory of standing behind the stainless steel double-shelved work table where it hit me that this is what I want to do. This is what I want to be when I grow up. I don't know if I thought chef, but probably I thought cook. That was 1974. Silverton, who initially thought she'd follow her beloved dad's footsteps into the law, changed majors a few times, then shifted to Sonoma State's Hutchins Liberal Arts College. She spent her summer breaks in kitchens, where she was often the lone white girl amongst a crew of Latino career cooks just there for the paycheck. A watershed moment came in 1976, her senior year.
I was studying for my finals, and I was having a very hard time focusing, and I didn't want to take the test that I was studying for. Didn't want to write the papers I was writing because I knew that there was nothing I was going to be doing with a degree. I called my parents up, and I said, I'm dropping out of school. I want to cook.
Unlike most parents of the day, hers were supportive. She spent a year cooking at 464 Magnolia, a chef-owned restaurant in Marin County, populated, like Chez Panisse, by charter members of a new generation of California cooks, college-educated Francophiles who worked from recipes out of books by Julia Child, concert pianist turned cookbook author Michael Field, Frenchman and Nouvelle Cuisine loather Raymond Oliver. It was also a distinctly California kitchen where gender dynamics were concerned.
It was a very supportive kitchen. People ask me what are my horror stories of being a young woman on her way up in a kitchen, and I had none of those experiences, says Silverton,
who recalls an idyllic environment where she talked movies, books, and politics with her co-workers. In 1977, at her father's insistence, she matriculated at Le Cordon Bleu in London, then returned to L.A., where she dined at Michael's with her parents shortly after it opened.
The place was busy and vibrant, with beautiful people, and there was great art on the walls. Michael was running around very well-dressed, but casual, kissing and hugging. You knew that you were in a place to be, and to be seen. The dining room of 464 Magnolia and the dining room of Chez Panisse were much more subdued in a Northern California way. This was Hollywood.
Silverton, touting her Le Cordon Bleu credentials, hit McCarty up for a job. She wanted in so badly that she settled for a position managing the restaurant's computerized program during lunch.
I was so terrible at it, says Silverton, and the cooks were so angry with me because I would very often put in the wrong order. I didn't know how to do all the things you do on a computer. Well, Jonathan found out somehow that that's not what I was there for. I think he was relieved because he couldn't believe someone as incompetent as me had that job. I probably did it for 3 weeks. He found out that I wanted to be in the kitchen, and so he approached me and said, "Look, I don't have anything on the hot side," because that's what I applied for. "But our pastry chef, Jimmy, is about to walk out the door. I need you to go in there and learn every single recipe you can."
Jimmy Brinkley had what Silverton calls a very fragile temperament. Because his assistant, a friend of Ken Frank's, had departed with him, Brinkley was flying solo and not happy about it. Again, Silverton accepted a suboptimal assignment, even though she describes herself as having been less than a C student in pastry at Le Cordon Bleu, where she found the adherence to dogma suffocating.
"There was no flexibility, no humor, no smiles. You did it by the book and you didn't ask questions. Whatever I made just didn't come out because I felt I was so constricted by the precision of it. Because they said, 'No, nothing will work unless you do it exactly that way.'"
Pastry was also scarcely a consideration for a young cook in the United States.
"It was a time in Los Angeles and possibly the country where it wasn't a given that all restaurants of a certain level had a pastry chef," says Silverton. "In Los Angeles especially, most of the restaurants bought their pastries from two people. One was La Mousse. You had a frozen mousse cake with all different flavors as a choice. And another was, I think, called L.A. Desserts or something. And you had a choice of pecan pie and apple pie and things like that. And everybody had the same menu. The few restaurants that made their desserts in-house only made desserts that had French names. Chocolate mousse, apple tart, crepe Suzette, things like that. So L'Hermitage was one of the first restaurants that not only had a beautiful dessert table, but the desserts did not have classic names. Jimmy brought that over to Michael's."
Under Brinkley, Silverton found a new world of pastry open to her.
"As I watched and learned from Jimmy, I saw how the pastry world was not restrictive, that there were certain scientific principles you had to adhere to. If you pour boiling milk all at once over eggs, they are going to scramble. If you cook something at 600 degrees, it's going to burn. Things like that. But as long as you stay within those guidelines, there's a lot of room for creativity. So not only did I just find that so exciting, it was the first time I saw somebody in the dessert world actually taste things and change as you taste. That was really eye-opening. I also love the fact that we had our own little corner of the kitchen, and we would come in at 4 a.m. when nobody was there, and we would leave by lunch service. I don't have to tell you that that's the part of the kitchen that I became the most happy at. I didn't want to do anything more to the hot side."
Silverton was fond of a chocolate caramel tart that Brinkley created, based on the flavors of a Heath bar and of a chocolate raspberry mousse cake, which she loved for its unconventional pairing. Like his L'Hermitage repertoire, Brinkley's Michael's desserts didn't have names, which Silverton found thrilling.
"You weren't making pecan pie, and all the desserts on the menu were named by the ingredients in the dessert."
Though Silverton doesn't remember it, McCarty vividly recalls encouraging her to bring a boldness to her desserts. Specifically, he remembers whipping cream aggressively to produce a super fluffy result. He considered the effect to be distinctly American. Brinkley didn't leave Michael's, as was feared, and Waxman and McCarty sent Silverton to France for 6 months to deepen her pastry knowledge at Gaston Lanotte's school in Plaisir, and to work in a bakery.
"I came back with so many ideas, and I started to make them for Michael, the things that I had learned and really impressed me. And Michael didn't like them. He thought they were too French. His flavor preference was some of the things that Jimmy was making that in truth were much more flavorful. They were much more condensed. So I'd take that chocolate raspberry mousse cake and I'd say, 'I know how to lighten that. I could take that, and if I add more egg whites, it'll be just like foam, right? I mean, egg whites don't have any flavor, so I'm sacrificing flavor for an airiness.' And Michael was very gentle in his critique of what I had brought back. And he was right. And I think my success, maybe, was the influence and the technique that I learned in France, merging with Jimmy's great knack for making flavorful things. And the two became my style."
Ironically, despite McCarty's redirection, Silverton believes that one of her key contributions to the evolution of restaurant desserts in America was the importing of French techniques that weren't common in the United States at the time.
"Whether it was certain chocolates that I brought back, or certain ways of whipping cream, or making a buttercream, or making a pâté sucré, then people would go work somewhere else, and they would take my recipes. That's just the way the food world works."
George Barber, a Scottish actor and front-of-house man who had worked at restaurants in London and Paris, found his way to L.A. in a drug- and alcohol-infused period in his life, went to work at L'Orangerie, then migrated to Michael's in 1980, at age 30. "They were young Turks," he says of McCarty, Waxman and Company. "They were hot. They were on fire." For Barber, McCarty's dining room was a world apart from others he'd worked in. He remembers McCarty drilling him on food during his interview, which surprised and impressed him, because waiting tables was largely seen as a rent-paying enterprise for actors and other creatives.
"Listen," McCarty told him, "I'm only hiring people that are really interested in what we're doing. I'm not interested in bullshit."
Despite his experience, Barber took a job as a busboy because McCarty insisted all staff work their way up the chain. Barber was also impressed that the Armani-clad McCarty trained him personally. "He took me through that restaurant from the color of the paint on the front door to the telephone lines on the side, to literally everything. The data and information that he gave me as we went along was just mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Then he went into the art. And of course, you know the whole story about the art. This is Richard Diebenkorn. This is his playing card series. Then we got into the food. Then we got into the service. One of the things that I learned about from Michael is that he's so thorough. He was so into what he was doing, but it was a total involvement of everybody. Everybody was connected. And I have to say it was my first real experience with really great integrity of what we were doing, that we were elevating the dining experience. But we were also putting the edge on it, the California edge. Have you seen The Player? You know that scene where they're like, 'I'll have my Pellegrino. 2 blocks of ice with lemon on the side, please.' This is California. Now, we're talking about the top restaurants in California that I worked at, where people were mollycoddled. They got what they wanted. There was no question. And they would alter the menu. They were very used to dismantling a menu and saying, 'I'll have this, I'll have this, I'll have this.' Michael wouldn't do it. He would encourage them and say, 'You've got to try this.'" McCarty was also willing to back his team, dramatically if necessary. Remembers Barber, "Once I had these people in the terrace and they were real Hollywood assholes, spoiled people. And we were used to reporting to each other what was going on so everyone knew what this table was like. So, you know, of course there's all that, the customer's always right. You want to break through and make them happy. So you've accomplished something with them. And finally he says to me, "Okay, George, I'll take over, dude." He goes over to the table, and by this time they're on their second bottle of Montrachet. Some big wine. They had the apps, and it was just going nowhere. So he went up to them. He said, "Look, everything that you have consumed and drunk up until now is on me. We can't help you anymore. We can't make you happy. We're never going to be able to make you happy tonight. So good night. I'm sorry it didn't work out. No hard feelings. Bye." And he goes, "Clear this table." And that was the end of that. Might be a $400, $500 bill 30 years ago. I thought, wow. I'd never seen that happen before. It impressed me because he really stood by what he said and felt. It's not that I'd kick anybody out of anywhere. I'm not an employer. But it gave me something to stand by, like a value, that what I'm doing is very right. McCarty also pioneered a practice that is now de rigueur in restaurants, the nightly staff meeting. "Now that's a given." "That was new," says Barber. "Michael would be there. Jonathan would be there. Everybody was there. It took place at 5 in the dining room. Dishes would be brought out. We'd be tasting. We were discussing it. It was a really involved part of the night. And that was a new thing." Around this time, Jeremiah Tower, at the behest of friend Cecilia Chang, who had ventured south to open an outpost of her groundbreaking San Francisco Chinese restaurant, The Mandarin, in Beverly Hills, made a tour of some L.A. hotspots, including West Beach Cafe and Chef Michael Roberts's Trumps, a hyper-creative West Hollywood restaurant and late-night industry dining destination. When he tasted the chicken at Michael's, he burst into the kitchen and demanded, "Who is able to do that?" "It was," says Tower, "just the most perfect reproduction of the best effort the French had ever done. I just went, oh my." It wasn't a verbal thing. It just hit me like a 9mm soft-nosed bullet. Years later, R.W. Apple would call Tower's San Francisco restaurant Stars, launched in 1984, the most democratic restaurant he had ever seen. "But it was only because of that inspiration that came out of L.A., says Tower. Things in Berkeley had changed in the intervening years. Tower had become a gun for hire, teaching at the California Culinary Academy, taking over the kitchens of existing, struggling restaurants such as the Balboa Cafe. Mark Miller, who had become a cook and eventually chef at Chez Panisse, departed the restaurant in September 1979 to pursue his personal passion for world cuisine, especially chilies and spices. Turns out you can't take the anthropologist out of the chef. He had made it his mission to visit 2 new countries each year and couldn't fit his developing style into Chez Panisse's resolutely French construct. When Susie Nelson, Chez Panisse's manager, felt the restaurant was becoming too snooty and left to open her own place, securing a space on 4th Street, she invited Miller to join her as partner and chef. He matched her investment, kicking in $35,000, and they launched 4th Street Grill that October. The restaurant drew a crowd immediately, and Nelson and Miller were repaid their investment in 4 months. The menu drew on influences from, you name it, America, England, Italy, Morocco. Miller kept up old relationships. His old Chez Panisse buddy, Jonathan Waxman, was a frequent visitor. One of his cooks, David Mahler, also recalls how Miller would sometimes bring his crew to Chez Panisse after hours, let himself into the unlocked kitchen, and fix them a snack. In December 1980, they opened Santa Fe Bar and Grill in the old Santa Fe Railroad Station in Berkeley. In his book, California Dish, Tower quipped that the location was an area more comfortable for prostitutes and drug dealers from Oakland than for Volvo and Saab drivers from the upper Berkeley Hills. That didn't stop him from dropping by on opening night and offering to lend a hand in the kitchen. Miller explored the food of the Yucatan at Santa Fe, boasted of being able to sell 200 orders of Peruvian beef hearts on brochette. But it was too much for him and Nelson, and after 5 months, he sold out his shares to focus on 4th Street Grill. One of those once-in-a-lifetime things. Back in West Hollywood, Patrick Terai rang up Ken Frank with a new possibility.
LaRouche is going down in flames. They need a chef partner. And I think you can make a deal.
The restaurant had occupied the former La Guillotine space on the Sunset Strip, with a sous chef and the original maitre d' from L'Hermitage. Patrick sat me down and showed me how I could line up 12 investors at $5,000 apiece and pay them back in food, says Frank. That October, still just 23 years old, Frank launched a restaurant with a name that was as chefy as it gets. Le Tuque, a reference to the tall white cylindrical hats worn by chefs in formal kitchens, on the Sunset Strip. Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder, in a sign of the growing interest in food and chefs, invested. The restaurant was well received, but in spring 1980, says Frank, his partner and maitre d', Henry Fizer, left a candle burning in the dining room, causing a fire. While the restaurant was closed for repairs, Terai invited Frank to be a part of what might have been the first pop-up. Because Ma Maison's clientele decamped to Cannes every May, Terai decided that rather than stay behind pining for the absent Rolls-Royces and movie stars, he'd open a Ma Maison Cannes for the duration of the festival. Terai, Puck, Frank, and a skeleton crew assumed command of the dining room of Chateau de la Napoule, just outside Cannes, and not coincidentally across the street from Terai's North Star, Outhier's L'Oasis. In Cannes, Puck, in an early demonstration of his innate versatility, cooked a traditional American dinner, which he knew would be exotic to the predominantly European crowd. I brought my butcher, Harvey Gossman, with me. He was cutting the steaks. Functioning out of house has become a part of every modern chef's skill set, but for Puck it was uncharted territory, and led to mishaps. I brought 300 or 500 avocados, but they were way too hard, and I freaked out, he says. I said, shit, they are still like stone. What should I do? And somebody gave me a stupid idea. They said, put it out in the sun, they will ripen. So I went up to the president of the festival, and he had a big balcony. I laid them all out there, and they got black and soft. So then I had to go to the farmer's market in Nice and buy avocados from Kenya or wherever, and then put it with sour cream and caviar. So we served this, and then we put our steaks, the New York steaks, which was very hard to get out of customs. Jacques Médecin, the mayor of Nice, helped us get them through customs. And then we bought the baked potatoes. They confiscated them. They didn't let the potatoes in. And corn on the cob, and then cheesecake for dessert. So it was all new, but it was a traditional American dinner. I think they loved it. People never saw a 14-ounce steak on a plate in France at that time. You got half of that, maybe. Ma Maison's customers flocked to the temporary outpost. Bob Fosse's autobiographical fever dream, All That Jazz, starring Roy Scheider and Jessica Lange, showed at the festival, and was feted with a party in its honor, for which a local pastry chef, an old friend of Puck's, created a special cake, and a fireworks display was put on over the Gulf of Napoule. It was an epic party, says Frank. One of those once-in-a-lifetime things. Terai rented out the luxurious Chateau de la Napoule and gave each member of the team his own bedroom. Between and after services, the crew cooked in the Chateau kitchen, dined at Verger's Moulin de Mougin, toured a cheese cave, enjoyed local specialties like soupe du poisson, cooked for them by friends of Puck's, and partied at local nightclubs. It remains a cherished memory for all three men, but it would be one of the last good times for Puck and Terai.
He offered me a job as a hat check girl, and I cried.
As Terai, Puck, and Frank depart Chateau La Napoule, we pan across the street to L'Oasis, and into the kitchen, where Puck's former cook, Susan Feniger, is working a one-year stage outside Outhier's auspices, arranged for her by Terai himself. Feniger had been raised in a Midwestern Jewish family that valued good food. Mom could cook anything, from noodle kugel to lasagna to fudge brownies, and was uncommonly attuned to the seasons, making vibrant salads in an iceberg wedge era. Feniger's first kitchen job was at Smith's Cafeteria in Toledo, Ohio, She loved it, but started college, dropped out, then found herself working for a cabinet maker in Vermont. Returning to college, this time in California, to study economics, she took a job in the school's cafeteria, learned rudimentary preparations, and loved the environment. Her boss pulled her aside one day, told her she should be studying cooking. She convinced her economics professor to let her spend her senior year in a customized, independent study program at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York, where Feniger became hopelessly devoted to kitchen life.
"I loved the camaraderie of it. I loved wearing uniforms. I loved eating and creating. It fit for me."
Feniger was the only woman in her class, but didn't feel the crush of sexism.
"Here's the thing. When I was in high school, I was this total Ayn Rand freak. I was this total libertarian to the fullest. I was studying philosophy and psychology, and I was reading Nathaniel Brandon, and then I ended up reading John Hospers."
The libertarian, bent toward self-sufficiency, bucked Feniger up against the chauvinism and harassment of the time.
"I probably was in total denial to thinking that was happening. I was, I think, pretty strong and confident. I was a tomboy as a kid. I'm sure it was there. I just didn't feel it. It clearly still is there, but it's just not one of those things that came into my consciousness."
Feniger shifted her attention to cooking. Her family, unlike many of the time, supported it. But her father had one requirement, that she learn the business of running a restaurant. Feniger worked for a hot second at the Quilted Giraffe, a new restaurant in New Paltz, New York, in its formative years. Then other jobs in upstate New York, and for Gus Ryde's Le Bon Auberge in Kansas City, and gave up novels and philosophical treatises for cookbooks. After 2 years, she moved to Chicago and took a job at Le Perroquet, a Nouvelle Cuisine restaurant and one of Chicago's finest, where she became the second ever woman in the kitchen. The first, still there when Feniger arrived, was Mary Sue Milliken. Milliken grew up the youngest of three sisters in an East Lansing, Michigan family, discovered cooking during high school in home ec classes and working in a pizzeria and a donut shop. She also had an epiphany when,
"I met a guy who was a chef in Chicago, a friend of my sister's, and he cooked dinner in like 45 minutes before my very eyes. I was 16, and in that moment, at that dinner, I decided I wanted to be a chef. And I went back to East Lansing, graduated from high school, and moved to Chicago. I really had no idea what kind of a career it was going to be."
She went to what she calls chef school in 1976 or 1977 at Washburn Trade School, which she describes as
a trade tech on the south side with a bunch of plumbers and pipe fitters and auto mechanics.
To ready students for the rigors of the industry, the school was open every day except Thanksgiving and Christmas. She supplemented her classes with restaurant work at night. Milliken was, she believes, one of two women in a class of 100.
"I think when you're in the middle of that kind of a situation, you don't allow yourself to acknowledge that it's harder for you than it would be if you were a different gender. So you just barrel through and try to make it happen," she says. "But in retrospect, you look at it and you can see that it was definitely challenging and hard. But I have the kind of personality that likes a challenge and likes to be a little bit of a rebel. So I think it fit me. But I had to go to the tequila bar after school and drink as much as the guys. I had to prove myself in kitchens. I had to lift heavy things. I was trying to really be as competitive as I could on that stage."
Milliken had heard of Alice Waters, but only vaguely. As with most people east of the Rocky Mountains, and with Californians for that matter, her attentions were focused on France. She found direction when Madeleine Peters' Favorite Recipes of the Great Women Chefs of France was published in 1979.
"I read it, like, five times. I couldn't believe it. Finally, I've found some role models."
This was typical of the time. With scant coverage or even real awareness of chefs, aspirants were hard-pressed for industry knowledge.
"There was no internet. There were very few of us. And chefs in those days, we worked 16, 18 hours a day, every day, day in and day out. And you didn't read lots of newspapers or magazines. Where were you going to get intel?
Millikan worked for the Conrad Hilton Hotel, then did a stage at Maxim's in Paris. Returning to Chicago, she wanted to work for Jovan Trbojevich at Le Perroquet, which had never employed a woman in the kitchen.
He said, I can't hire you because you're a woman, and you'd cause havoc in my kitchen, says Millikan. I said, how will I do that? He said, you're too pretty. All the men would go crazy. I just couldn't believe that. He offered me a job as a hat check girl, and I cried. And then I started a letter and phone call campaign where I called him every 5 minutes, wrote him letters. And he finally said, are you going to sue me? I said, no, I just want a job. So he said, all right, come in tomorrow. It's $3.25 an hour, minimum wage. Of course, now he would get sued over it. But then, you know, there were times when like 17-year-old boys would be making 12. I can't remember, maybe it was $8 an hour, and I would be making $5.50. And I was 2 years older, with 4 years more experience. But that stuff happened, and you just persevered and kept going.
Fenniger arrived about 18 months after Millikan.
I think he thought he had the best deal on the planet because I was working circles around all the guys in the kitchen, and I was so cheap. So he took another, says Millikan. I had never worked with anybody who had the same sensibility, the same work ethic. We really enjoyed working together. The chef there at the time was a total asshole to me, says Fenniger. Complete. But he was a great chef, and I felt like I learned a ton from him. It was a totally great restaurant, and it was a great experience. It was the beginning of Nouvelle Cuisine, and they were just doing amazing things. We both learned a ton there.
Fenniger moved to Los Angeles and Ma Maison in 1978, and fell right away for the laid-back culture, calling Millikan to breathlessly report,
I can't believe you can wear tennis shoes here. You don't have to wear a chef's hat.
She also shared a detail that amuses Millikan today.
You're not going to believe this weirdo who's in the kitchen here. He doesn't even know how to do the ordering. We have 3 cases of avocados, and he orders 3 more. They're just going to spoil. We chuckle about that, because it was Wolf.
Around the same time that Fenniger pushed off from Ma Maison to work at L'Oasis, Millikan embarked on her own stage under chef Dominique Namias at Olympe in Paris. The two kept in touch that year, and when it was over, met up at Millikan's apartment in Paris's 14th arrondissement, killed a few bottles of wine, and as a rainbow appeared in the sky, came to a conclusion.
We decided that we had to open a restaurant together, says Millikan. I think being a woman in a man's field, you kind of quickly learn that if you want to call the shots, you're going to have to start out small and do your own thing, because trying to work your way up through the hierarchy in a male-dominated field is just pretty hard.
Millikan, along with Lazaroff, New York chefs and restaurateurs Lydia Bastianich and Anne Rosenzweig, Providence's Joanne Killing, and California's Elka Gilmore, helped start Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, spearheaded by chefs Barbara Tropp and Joyce Goldstein in 1993. A similar organization, the New York Women's Culinary Alliance, was founded by Sarah Moulton and Maria Rouge at Sally Dar's La Tulipe restaurant in 1981. Both continue to thrive today. Both cooks were broke. Millikan had even sold her car to finance her European adventure and lived off her savings overseas. So they went where the short-term money was, Millikan to Chicago and a private chef gig, Fenniger back to L.A., where she picked up lunch shifts at Ma Maison. By night, she moonlighted, running the kitchen for the owners of an espresso bar located next to their L.A. iWorks shop, also on Melrose. It was modest, to say the least. A 900-square-foot cafe with 9 tables, 11 bar stools, a pastry case, an espresso machine, and no proper kitchen. The owners, over the novelty of running a food service business and frustrated by the daily grind, asked Fenniger if she'd like to run it. She seized the opportunity, shortcomings of the space be damned, setting up 2 hibachis, a hot plate, and a prep table in the parking lot out back.
The first special I ever ran was veal tongue with lobster sauce and sautéed pears. I made it on a hot plate, says Finnegar. We were 2 years into it before the health department came by to say we really couldn't do that.
Milliken came to L.A. in February 1981, overcame her Midwesterner's wariness of California, known back home as the land of fruits and nuts, went back to Chicago, packed up her things, and by early spring she and Finnegar were together in the kitchen at what became City Cafe, drawing primarily on their French backgrounds, with an emphasis on country over Nouvelle.
Confit of duck on a salad with pickled cabbage. Or we would do cold poached salmon with tomatoes and herbs and olive oil and salt. Or we would do grilled turkey. We couldn't afford veal, so we were really into turkey for some reason. We'd slice it thinly and pound it and make turkey escalope with lemon and shallots and brown butter.
Because they had no refrigeration and required a daily delivery, local purveyors didn't want to service them. Puck, flexing his growing muscle, intervened on their behalf. Finnegar and Milliken found their customers as open-minded as Waxman did, so they began adding organs such as lamb kidneys to the menu.
There was a dialogue and an interchange between the customers and the kitchen, says Milliken.
The interaction was enhanced by the fact that the bathroom was through the kitchen.
Whenever a movie star would come in, we'd tell the busboy, "Give them lots of water so they have to come in the bathroom."
Highlights: Gilda Radner, Stevie Wonder, and the giraffe-tall Julia Child, who bumped her head on the pots and pans hanging like a mobile over the kitchen.
They would ask about the food, says Milliken. They'd sit at the bar. They'd look through the window to the kitchen, and we were just bursting with excitement about cooking. We would cook from morning until night, every day, 6 days a week, and then on Mondays we would just sleep all day. We had so much fun. We'd write the menu on a chalkboard every day. We'd be out there filling the pastry case with homemade desserts. We had a huge pastry menu, too. As soon as I got in the cafe, I was like, we're not going to buy any desserts from the outside. There was a lot of excitement around the food, and I would do things like lamb's tongue salad that people loved. I was just very impressed. It was an artistic thing, eating in L.A., more so than it was in the Midwest.
Emboldened, the women began expanding their repertoire into unprecedented eclecticism. Finnegar returned from a trip to India, added potato samosas with chutneys, a vegetarian plate with dals, and lamb curry to the menu. Milliken returned from Thailand, and on went a Thai sausage salad, duck red curry, eggplant curry, and pickled tomatoes. A trip to the Japanese fish market was followed by monkfish liver. They persuaded a garden in Brentwood to grow organic produce for them, including black mustard, sprouted from seeds Finnegar brought back from India.
We weren't making it accessible, says Finnegar. We were just doing the food we loved. As long as people were buying it, we never thought about it. We never thought about what the press will say. We didn't go there.
One day, it hit Finnegar in a flash, the same way it had hit Waxman and Puck in that passing glance at Ma Cuisine. That step by step, imperceptibly as it had happened, she had entered a new world.
Oh my God, she thought. We can do whatever we want. This is very sad, Wolf. This is not okay.
Barbara Lazaroff, then a stranger to the restaurant industry, saw the inherent injustice in its power structure. Puck had saved Ma Maison, but Tarai was reaping the spoils. The dynamic was symbolized in the paycheck Lazaroff found in Puck's bathroom one day, an amount so meager she assumed it was a week's pay, and insufficient at that. When Puck told her that's what he earned every 2 weeks, the New Yorker within was unleashed.
You've got to be shitting me, she snapped. I earned more than that when I was 18 years old. This is despicable. You need to go to talk to Patrick and tell him to double your salary. What? Double it.
Says Lazaroff.
Wolfgang had transformed Ma Maison. It was going to go out of business, and Wolf transformed it and made it a huge success with a great name. So yeah, I said, this is very sad, Wolf. This is not okay.
The next day I went to Patrick, says Puck. I said, we have to talk. You have to double my salary or I'm going to leave. He said, go talk to Sid.
Sid was the accountant,
He had a little office there. I said, Sid, you have two choices. You have to double my salary, or else I'm leaving. This is ridiculous. He said, okay.
Lazaroff also helped the newly single Puck clean up his home, hammering ice blocks out of the freezer, sorting through storage boxes piled up all over the place. He also only owned one fork. In time, she'd convince him to do a $35,000 renovation of his kitchen. One of the boxes contained what Lazaroff calls faux shares.
What are these? She asked him.
I'm a partner in Ma Maison, he said.
No, you're not, insisted Lazaroff. These are not real.
They went back and forth, but Lazaroff insisted.
They were bullshit. And sure enough, she says, they were bullshit. He just printed out shit. A thing that looks like a bond.
Wolf is very naive, says Lazaroff.
Puck was working lunch and dinner 6 days a week, and dinner on Sunday. She'd pick him up in the afternoon, and the two drove to her place and hit the sack between services. One afternoon, Puck turned on the television, saw one of his waiters on the small screen, promoting an industry charity marathon.
What is he doing on TV? Puck exclaimed. He's not even a cook.
Do you want to be on TV? Asked Lazaroff.
Well, yeah.
Lazaroff worked her burgeoning L.A. network, eventually reaching independent casting director Lillian Mizrahi, and pitched her Puck.
That's really funny, said Mizrahi, according to Lazaroff. We wanted him to come on to cook something on one of these shows, but Patrick Tarai said, oh, no, I go on, or somebody else. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't like doing that.
Lazaroff pushed her luck, asking if there was a national show that might book him. Mizrahi made some calls, came back with Our Magazine, a syndicated features program hosted by Gary Collins that aired in 117 markets. Puck did a cooking demo the next week. All the while, Lazaroff was training Puck for stardom. Despite Puck's protestations, according to her and others, his English was substandard, so he'd rely on a meager set of sticky one-liners in customer interactions. A diner might say, how are you? And he'd respond, not as good as you. In their limited time together, Lazaroff read Time and Newsweek to him to punch up his fluency. Many of their contemporaries say that Puck wouldn't be where he is today had Lazaroff not come along. Puck, before we began recording our interview, groused that this impression annoys him, and Ruth Reichel understands why.
There's nobody like Wolfgang. He's incredibly talented. He's the best manager. People love him. People who work for him love him. Even people who have left. Nobody will say anything bad about him. And he's got an amazing palate. He loves to cook. I watched him once in the kitchen at Spargo. This is when Sherry Yard was there as the pastry chef. And he was going through, tasting. He just stuck his finger in the ice cream and said, why did you use different ginger? And she was like, how do you even know that? He's unlike many businessmen chefs who start hating to cook. He is always there. It's like I said, I never saw Michael McCarty in the kitchen. I never didn't see Wolf in the kitchen. He'd invite you to his house. He loves cooking. He'd get in the kitchen and push people aside. I once asked him, why do you open so many restaurants? And he said, look, you develop these chefs, and they're really good, and at a certain point they're going to leave you. So he said, instead of letting them leave, I open up a restaurant for them to run. Every chef in America should know that, right? That you become partners. You develop people, and you become partners with them. I mean, the idea that Tom Kaplan, senior managing partner of Puck's Corporation, is still working for him, what, 35 years later? It's amazing. In this business, how many people have that tight organization that people stay and stay and stay and stay and stay? That's what I mean when I say he's a genius.
That said, Reichel does believe that Lazaroff accelerated the process. So I believe Puck when he tells me that he had concluded that the only way to get what he wanted at Ma Maison was to become a partner. And the only way to accomplish that was to create a second restaurant, force Tarai to join forces with him, and create a management company as 50-50 equals. Puck says that Tarai promised him they'd take over La Tour d'Argent someday. My uncle is so old. In 5 years,
We're going to run La Tour d'Argent,
Tarai told him.
Then we went to La Tour d'Argent. The uncle comes over and says hello, shook everybody's hand at the table. Did not say,